Hello, and welcome to the first episode of our fourth season of the Friends of Sanctuary podcast. I'm Marianne Bartels, Chief Investment Strategist at Sanctuary Wealth. To kick off this new season, I am so thrilled to welcome our guest, Gargi Chowdhury, Chief Investment and Portfolio Strategist of the Americas at BlackRock. Gargi, thank you so much for joining us.
So wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You know, Gargi, we're starting off this year with so many things happening. In Chinese astrology, it's the year of the fire horse, and it's not supposed to start until, I think it's February 17th. But fire seems to be very active. A lot happening with Venezuela, with Greenland. Yet markets are continuing to hit record all-time highs. So you still even have fire in the equity market. And BlackRock just came out with their year ahead outlook. I'd love for you to kind of start with your big macro picture. Where are we in the economy? Because kind of seems the market economy is on fire. Where are you seeing the U.S. economy in 2026?
Marianne, such a great question and great parallel there to the year of the fire horse. So maybe I'd start off with strength. And the economic strength that we're seeing right now is coming from a few cylinders, actually. Obviously, the AI theme, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is one driver of economic growth, but it's not the only one. And I think that's what's keeping the equity markets so well bid. So our view for growth for 2026 is still above potential, just like 2025 was. But importantly, because we're also going to see the Fed continue to cut rates for, at least the what's priced in by the market, which is about two cuts, I think that's going to be quite a tailwind. So economic outlook, positive, rates going lower, equity is likely to be very supported in this backdrop.
So let's talk about interest rates. So the Fed, for actually now almost 2 years, has been cutting interest rates, yet it looks like they'll continue, which is very unusual for a strong economy in an environment where we have strong corporate profits. Do you have a target of where you think the Fed could get to in terms of Fed funds?
Yeah. So we think that they're probably likely to get to what their estimate of neutral is, which is right around that 3%. And frankly, one of the big changes of 2026, and we highlight that in our investment directions, which is our outlook that came out in January. You know, one of the big differences this time around when we think about the Fed is that they've told us that they'll kind of provide a little bit of a backstop, if you will. So if we do see a shock to growth, which is not our base case, again, reiterating that we're expecting above trend growth in 2026, but a shock to growth, the Fed can cut very quickly below that neutral level. So we still think getting to three, maybe a little below three makes sense. And they're going to do that at a time when the economy is stable because the level of rates allow them to do that. And of course, you know, we have the giant debt and interest payments, as you know, are staggeringly high, and they have to do something about it. And bringing interest rates down is one way of being able to do that while inflation's coming down.
And it also supports the job market, right? We continue to get data saying, even though we have a strong economy, that the labor market is not as strong. So does that help them also to cut interest rates?
Yes. So when, you know, obviously I know you do this as well, but when I listen to all of the Fed speakers, the presidents and the different governors and Fed Chair Powell himself speak, one of the things that he has highlighted in the recent FOMC meetings is the risk with respect to the labor market. And obviously, we had this period of time when we didn't have too much government data. But the few things that we heard from the labor market was around, I won't call it weakness, but just moderating from really, really high levels. So what we watch are stressed environments. Like, are we beginning to see things like job openings decline in a meaningful manner? Are we beginning to see rates of layoffs pick up in a meaningful manner? And we're not. But the Fed is still signaling that that is very important to them. They don't want to have to cut rates because it's an emergency. They want to cut rates because they can afford to. And I think that allows the Fed, especially with the backdrop of declining inflation, and especially if, you know, you talked about Venezuela at the start, if we have some impact on supply in crude oil prices and we have more of a decline in headline inflation, just allows them to bring rates back from that very high level that we started off this year at, closer to neutral.
So as we're doing the podcast, Powell is close to his 100-day mark, right? Because he will be stepping down and the president will be appointing a new Fed chair. Do you think as we get a new Fed chair, the policy can change, or is things just stay status quo?
You know, I think about that a lot, and I look at what the markets are telling us as it comes to policy, right? And the markets are telling us that they're not really worried about any form of runaway inflation or any massive shocks to risk premiums. If you look at inflation markets or if you look at the shape of the yield curve, it's telling us that policy should be similar to what policy has been, which is driven by their mandate of obviously unemployment in the context of price stability or stable employment in the context of price stability. You know, they obviously do policy as a committee. I think for all of us that love the markets and all your listeners that are listening to this, who follow the markets, it's in our best interest that we have a really independent central bank with a chair that runs policy based on what the economic data is telling us. And I think that's what we have.
If not, the bond market will signal that they're not doing something
correct. The inflation market will, and they haven't. And that's our greatest signal. So whenever, you know, I grew up in the inflation markets, I grew up a tips trader when the tips market was really at its infancy. And I look at the whole world in terms of what are real rates telling us? What are inflation expectations are telling us? And inflation expectations are telling us, at least for now, for the next 5-10 years, we're going to expect stable inflation at a little bit over 2.25%.
Oh, I hope you're right. You have no idea. Let's pivot a little bit. Yeah. Go to the equity market. It's all been about artificial intelligence, AI. Last year, I countless TV appearances. And the question was, are we in an AI bubble? So I'm going to pose to you, is technology and AI still the leadership, and are we in a bubble?
Yeah, and you know, to your point, that's a question that comes up so much. Obviously, I've heard you speak on TV, and you know, our clients ask us that as well around, is this something that is a fad that's going to go away? It's a bubble. It's going to burst. It's the, you know, it's something that we won't be, you know, if it's in our portfolio, we really regret owning it. And I want to take a giant step back and acknowledge that suddenly about 40% of the S&P is in a handful of tech names. And that can be, again, it can be a little bit concerning when you look at what $1 that you spend in the market, if 4 cents of that goes towards a few names. I understand where the concern is coming from, so I won't acknowledge it. But at the same time, when we look at valuations, especially from sort of the start of the year of 2025 to the start of the year of 2026, what we've actually seen is AI stocks, particularly a basket of AI stocks, are actually now cheaper than they were in the beginning of the year from a PE perspective. They were about, you know, from about 28.7 coming down to about 25.6 on a forward PE basis. Now, why is that? It's because all of these companies have been able to grow their earnings in a meaningful manner. So you have these top AI names that have about, you know, over the last 3 years, 30% net income as opposed to 3% for non-AI. So certainly I see where concerns are coming from given the rapid growth, but we emphatically don't think it's a bubble. I think AI is going to be with us for a long time. Hopefully it's making us productive already and will continue to do so for the entire economy.
As you bring up productive, it's really impacting productivity. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we're seeing sustainably improved productivity. Do you continue to see that happening?
I think that is one of the other drivers of a GDP. You know, earlier we were talking about our expectations of growth for 2026. One theme that we highlighted was this above trend growth in 2026 as much as it was in 2025. And that does come from AI, to be clear, and all of the investment spending, but productivity is a big driver of that too, right? So, you know, we all know this, but just to reiterate, what drives growth of any economy? It's the number of people we have, so demographics, and how hard they work, so productivity, or how well that's measured. So if your demographics are declining, we all better hope for our sakes that productivity is going to continue to rise. And that is what we expect to be the case. And that, again, is one of the reasons that we think is going to drive GDP higher. Now, it's not just AI-related productivity. To be clear, it's logistics, it's innovation and financing. It's across the economy. It's not just AI, it's supply chains. All of that leading to more productive economies.
So you do a lot with portfolios and constructing portfolios. So as you're constructing portfolios, understanding the concentration risk, mm-hmm. when you want to invest in growth, where are you seeing the opportunities?
Yeah, so acknowledging that a lot of portfolios that we are looking at have actually had a underweight to growth. Areas of the market, right? So they've most advisor portfolios that we look at have had an overallocation, an overweight to US, but actually an underweight to the growth theme. So what that means is they've moved into value and small caps, which, you know, have had periods of outperformance, but obviously in the last 10 years, if you haven't had that overweight to growth, you might have missed out on some of the returns. So right now we are telling investors, number one, focus on, if you are underweight specifically, focus on very targeted AI-related equity themes in your portfolio. But at the same time, there are other non-AI themes that are also really important in an equity portfolio or the equity sleeve of your portfolio right now, which interestingly is a good complement or a good antidote to AI, if you will.
What are they, right? Yes, what are they?
So a couple here. So number one, we're talking a lot about value. We haven't spoken about value for a few years, but you know, as we were writing investment directions in November, December, we started looking at the earnings growth potential, the 12-month forward earnings growth for S&P 500 value specifically. And of course, growth is still going to have a slightly higher earnings growth, so about 19% compared to the 12% for value, but it's not the level, but the change. Compared to 2024 and 2025, that spread between value and growth really compressing, we think is going to be a main driver. And obviously within that specifically, we think financials with massive pickup in M&A, looking at the number of deals that have picked up just in the last quarter of 2025, you've had record number of deals come into the market, very beneficial for financials and of course, a steepening yield curve, which is also our view. So financials, but value more broadly. And then I'll also say that specifically, there are other areas that we think can continue to benefit. Miners, for example, gold miners, for example, has been an area of the market that we think has done well and can continue to do so. We also think that another area, again, an antidote to AI, if you will, is looking at dividends specifically. High dividends is an area of the market where, you know, if you just think about it, if you're a company paying dividends, you have the cash flow to be able to do so. A lot of dividends tend to be those cyclical companies in a world where you have higher growth and lower interest rates. Cyclicality will outperform. And these are cash flow rich companies. So they haven't gone and done the CapEx in data center warehouses. So all of those are areas that might not outperform AI, but will, if you have that overweight to AI, it might actually help you have a nice balanced portfolio.
I actually agree with that. I just wrote about the dogs of the Dow, which is dividends over growth, but it sounds, dogs sounds terrible, I understand, where you take the 10 highest Dow yielding stocks, and it's not being talked about, but they produced on a total return basis last year, 19%,
yeah,
which is not a bad return. Getting to your point that you can get price appreciation and the growth in the dividend in your total return.
And if I could make one other point as we're thinking about the equity portfolio, another theme that we uncovered in advisor portfolio was a perennial underweight to international markets, which of course, congratulations, over the last decade, you've done really well if you've had that. But 2025, you did not. If you had that underweight to either DM or even EM, both stocks and bonds. So this is one year, and you know, obviously 2025 was, but 2026 as well, we continue to think diversifying into EM specifically.
Emerging markets.
Yeah, emerging markets specifically might make sense. And a good beneficiary of the AI trade. So a good way to diversify within the AI trade, moving away from US AI theme, or not moving away, but in addition to diversifying away into international AI themes. So exposure to countries like South Korea, exposure to Taiwan, again, different parts of the AI value chain.
Any thoughts on Europe or Japan in terms of international developed markets?
Absolutely. So I think for Europe, look, it just doesn't have the same earnings growth as the US does. So being very tactical within where in Europe instead of broad European allocations, we like financials as well as defensives. I mean, those are two areas that did well in 2025. We think some of that momentum continues.
And Germany's spending a lot.
And that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then within Japan, I think that's a complete reflation story, right? I mean, as I said, I grew up in
35-year bear market.
Exactly. Huge reflation story. This is a country where inflation has not occurred over the last three decades. And to finally see that come to the markets, or a little bit of inflation, is a good thing, as all tips traders like to say. And I think that that passes through into profit margin. So Japan is your reflation, but again, that value-oriented antidote to growth in your portfolio that we think works really well.
We agree with you, just so you know. Another way to diversify is through mid-caps or small caps. Any thoughts on where, in terms of capitalization, would you go down in cap or do you want to stay up in the large cap space?
Yeah, so we're still very much focused on being focused on companies in the large cap space. I think, you know, we're about to enter, or we have been in this K-shaped economy right after the pandemic and the recovery of the pandemic. I think that K-shape, unfortunately, is just getting more and more dispersed, and bigger companies that are able to use scale more effectively are able to generate more profits, and smaller companies, fortunately or unfortunately, are remaining private for longer because you can access capital. So large caps is still our preferred part of the capital stack, recognizing that there can be periods of small cap outperformance. And we don't think that that's likely to sustain year over year because we're just not seeing that earnings growth that compares to large cap.
And that K-shape is where the higher end consumer is spending more than the lower end consumer, but both are spending. Both are spending, but the higher end consumer is probably spending almost double what the lower end consumer is spending.
Absolutely. And the higher end consumer is spending more and doing better, as well as the larger companies. And I guess moving the K-shaped economy conversation to K-shape in the stock market conversation, the larger companies are being able to use scale more efficiently. And I think that's what sort of drives this thesis that large cap for now, again, remains the part of the market that will be able to benefit and have more earnings.
They have the leverage.
The small cap companies, I think, have another problem, which is the debt burden remaining very high, therefore profitability remaining very low.
Some of them don't make earnings.
Exactly. So till we see that change, it's hard to, you know, turn positive on small cap. The other thing that I want to point out is, again, looking at advisor portfolio, the average advisor is very overweight the small cap part of the capital stack. And I think that that's something that if you happen to have, unwittingly, you might want to go back and look at that to recognize if that's something you still want to have in a world where companies are staying private for a much longer period of time. So by the time they go public, they're no longer in the small cap benchmark. They might go public as one of the largest seven companies in the stock market.
Now, one of the areas that fall under value is energy. Mm-hmm. And right, we're getting a lot of questions because of the military action in Venezuela. And the president has publicly said that we will have access to that oil. Where do you see the oil sector fitting into value?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been interesting watching the price action just in the first few days of this news. First of all, with our expectations is that over time, supply can certainly increase into a already very globally oversupplied energy market if we can get more of the US companies, you know, sort of investing heavily in CapEx and infrastructure in Venezuela. Those are many ifs. And I think whenever you have a sentence with many ifs, what that means is it's a long duration trade.
That's so, heard out to 2030.
Right. So just recognizing that obviously this was a country that at one point was producing about 3 million barrels of oil a day. And now that's below a million, about 900,000. You know, can we get back up to that 3 million level in a hurry? No. Can we get above a million, maybe get to 1.25 million over the next year or so? That's still additional barrels into an economy that's, or into a supply chain that's already pretty oversupplied. I think that can have some downwards pressure on oil prices for sure. And again, as a result of that headline inflation and Fed policy. So I can see that. But I think this takes a little bit of time to play out. And I think what's happening, and you're beginning to see this dispersion play out in crude oil prices versus some of the energy stocks. And, you know, from not to go too much into single names, but you're beginning to see some of those producers that already have presence or have had presence over the last three decades in Venezuela having a little bit of positive performance. So again, this brings me back to the opportunities exist outside of AI, and you know, obviously value and cyclicals can benefit having those as a part of your portfolio, recognizing that if we can get this they've got about 300 million barrels reserve, if we can at some point, even in 10 years, we can sort of help develop that and produce that into the markets, that's going to bring oil prices down. So that can overall have an impact on the macroeconomics.
So let's talk about the portfolio for fixed income. You're looking for rates to come down. That's very good for the bond market. So as advisors are trying to build out their fixed income for 2026, where are you seeing the opportunities?
Sure. So we are expecting rates to come down. And by that, I mean the rates in the very front end of the curve to come down because the Fed controls that. So expect definitely two rate cuts from the Fed, maybe a little bit more backloaded. They can go more than that. They can go up to three, but bring rates down to that 3% level. You know, when you look at what happened to the 10-year note or longer, pretty much quite range-bound for most of the year. Can we see another year where the 10-year yield remains around the 4% level? Absolutely. So the opportunity here, we think, is really in that belly of that curve, the sweet spot. And by the belly, I mean sort of looking at that 3 to maybe all the way out to the 10-year part of the curve. The beauty for advisors building a portfolio that are always looking for diversification tools is the negative correlation between stocks and bonds are back. We didn't have them for a few years, and you do want that because you want different parts of your portfolio to do different things. You are getting that negative correlation, especially between stocks and the belly of the curve, that 3 to 7 year part. So to that extent, we think investors should be focusing on owning fixed income for income and also for that diversification benefit. But for now, we would stay away from the very long end. We still think that there isn't quite enough term premium built in for all of the debt that's out there. Look, it's the term premium is at a higher level. And of course, term premium is that risk, is that pay, what you want to get paid for owning a bond for a higher period of time. You're not getting paid quite enough. It's better than it was, but not as good as it can be. Keeping your duration, keeping your interest rate sensitivity to that about the 10-year part of the curve, we think makes sense. And really focusing on harnessing income in fixed income markets in that belly of the curve. So looking at emerging market bonds, looking at all-in yields and sort of credit markets, securitized credit, I think that makes a lot of sense.
So you're willing to take credit risk? Are you willing to take credit risk?
Absolutely. Okay. You should be very thoughtful about credit risk given the level of spreads. Spreads have tightened meaningfully. If you look at over the last 10 years, and if you just look at spreads on a standalone basis, they are at the, if not the extreme rich end of their spectrum, somewhere in the highest percentile. But at the same time, all in yields is what people buy. So when you're looking at high yield, you're not focused so much on that 300 basis point spread. You're much more focused on that 7% coupon. So absolutely, but be a little bit more discerning in credit spreads, because you want to make sure, especially when spreads are this tight, that you're focusing on the companies that are able to sort of benefit from that top of that K that we were talking about.
So you talked about metal stocks, but we haven't talked about gold or silver or copper. And they keep reaching record all-time highs. And gold in a traditional portfolio has been used for a hedge, not so much silver and copper. Where do you land on precious metals? And you can include copper, palladium, zinc, aluminum. They're all moving.
Metals
just seem to be in a new bull market. So where do you stand in terms of trying to add metal exposure outside of maybe equities?
Yeah, so recognizing that this isn't usually a big component of portfolios. So in the last few years, gold has increasingly become a part of advisor portfolios. We see that in the data, but some of the other metals, not necessarily so. There has been a little bit of performance chasing that's going on, especially I would say in things like copper. I wouldn't put all the metals in one basket because I think they play a different role in a portfolio. So as it pertains to gold, I think with all the concerns that we sort of touched upon with respect to higher deficits, the reason why we don't like the very long end, with respect to sort of concerns around geopolitical risk, which we sort of talked about with respect to Venezuela, I do think there is a lot of value in owning gold in your portfolio. And we're seeing investors do that. 2025 was a huge year for investors, advisors actually increasing their allocation to gold. And despite the price returns, I think there is still opportunity, especially if you recognize that while it's volatile, it also has low correlation to other parts of your portfolio. Silver, on the other hand, I would say is a much more of a, it's not a geopolitical risk. If growth is solid, it's obviously used in many of the AI as an input for many of the AI innovations. I think that is much more of a risk on global growth phenomenon metal. Also having done well, same with copper. I think that's very much around demand expectations as opposed to supply shocks. So supply shocks in copper is what's driving those prices. I think there's been a little bit of performance chasing that's taken place. I'd say much more positive gold. And I'd also throw in a new one. I'd say Bitcoin is another one that we're more and more increasingly telling investors to carve out a special allocation for. Whereas with respect to silver and copper and a few others, I think that, you know, again, a diversified commodity basket might make sense, but some of those prices have moved quite a bit.
Let's talk a little bit more about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. BlackRock has the largest ETF, IBIT, out there. It seems that we have validated that crypto is a real market and that it should maybe, if it's appropriate, be something that goes into your portfolio. How do you help advisors figure out if a Bitcoin is appropriate and what type of allocation do you put in your portfolio?
Absolutely. And it is our pleasure to help our clients sort of understand that this is an asset class that can be a very valuable addition to your portfolio, as long as you recognize that the volatility of the asset class is such that you need to size it very appropriately. So how we talk about these conversations is thinking about what is your risk budget for active risk taking. And when you think about your total risk budget, about allocating maybe, you know, a quarter of that or a little bit less than that to this specific asset class, because again, it's one specific, IBIT is one ticker. So you don't want to use up a lot of your risk budget given the volatility.
Where do you take it from? Like if you have a portfolio and you say, okay, my client can take the volatility, where do I take, if I don't have cash,
right?
Where do I take
that from? Absolutely. And I would say you shouldn't, first of all, one thing to come back to the point I was making earlier is the sizing that we think makes sense is somewhere between 1-2% of your portfolio and not too much higher than that, because again, that increases the volatility too much. Where do you fund it from? We think you should, again, if someone has a lot of, if you have that overweight to some of the very concentrated tech stocks, that could be a good place for you to fund it from. If you have already an underweight, which we found, we talked about, if you already have an underweight to tech in your portfolio, that's obviously not where you should be funding it from. I actually don't think you should fund it from cash. Most advisors have cash for a specific reason. If you have, you know, 1-2% cash, you're probably supposed to let it be there. Obviously, if you have 14% cash, which is as high as what I've seen in portfolios, then that can be a different conversation. But we're not necessarily seeing clients move from cash all the way down the risk spectrum to Bitcoin. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that. What I would say is think about the risk, the most concentrated part of your equity portfolio. So if that is large cap tech, then that's where it comes from. If it isn't, if it happens to be small cap, maybe that's where it comes from. But think about your most concentrated exposure because that's what you'd be getting.
So BlackRock has a lot of data on wealth management and how advisors are positioned. What are some of the things and insights? You've talked a few about a few of them. What are some of the major insights that you're gaining from looking at this data?
Sure. It's my pleasure to share some of that with you. So the first one, which I love, is buying the dip. So investors are, and more wealth investors as opposed to institutional investors, are actually buying the dip in the market. And we find that in flow information, we've done a lot of analysis. And even when we had that pullback in April of 2025, a lot of cash sort of moved away from money market holdings into the equity market, which is just fantastic. Buying the dip, at least, you know, over 2025, and we think in 2026 as well, is going to continue to work. And we should always be focused on staying invested. And when the market pulls back, use that as an opportunity to add as opposed to an opportunity to express fear. The second thing that we found, and I sort of highlighted it, but just to sort of come back to it a little bit, is an overallocation to US versus a broad sort of global benchmark. So institutional investors have a much more globalized portfolio, whereas US investors have about an 80% allocation to US versus if you look at a traditional sort of MSCI, ACWI type benchmark. So an overweight to US, which obviously means the corollary is an underweight to the rest of the world. And again, right now, I do think that moving to emerging markets might make some sense. The third one I would say is an increasing allocation to alternative strategies. So not alternative assets, so not gold or Bitcoin, but actually alternative strategies. So recognizing that 2022 was a year where you didn't get that traditional stock bond correlation work in your favor, what we found was right after that period, a lot of investors sort of seeked out liquid alternative solutions, which is sort of, you know, strategies that are minimizing your drawdown because they're beta neutral. So if the market's suddenly down 20%, you're not going to drop 20% because you are beta neutral. A lot of those type of strategies in equities and fixed income are becoming really popular, which makes sense. Because in a higher than 2% or, you know, higher than pre-pandemic inflation world, your stock bond correlation might be a little less reliable. So that rise of liquid alternative assets has been really interesting. So that's something we've seen. And then maybe another last point that that I want to make is what we already talked about a little bit is just with respect to with gold, there has been an increased adoption in terms of adding gold as an alternative asset, as well as, you know, Bitcoin a little bit, but certainly gold is something that investors are more and more embracing, which is great to see. So it's no longer just a traditional 60-40. It is more and more moving towards a, maybe a 50-30-20, with the 20 coming from a variety of alternative assets or alternative strategies that are adding alpha to a portfolio.
This has been such a wealth of information and so dynamic, and we've touched on so many different areas. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you think investors should know?
You know, yes, I do. I think we painted a pretty, hopefully, a picture of optimism for the economy because of growth and the Fed and AI. But I also want to point out that there's always headlines. We just saw that with Venezuela. There, you know, this one wasn't a negative shock to the markets, but there can be others. We saw that repeatedly in 2025. So maybe one thing to talk about is that, especially when markets have had three consecutive years of double-digit returns, a pullback is healthy. If not, I won't call it normal, but I'll certainly call it healthy. So we didn't talk about it, but there could be, by the time we publish this, there could have already been a 5, 7, even 10% correction in the markets. View that as healthy because the backdrop of the market is positive and you're supposed to sort of use that as an opportunity to add to your shopping basket, if you will.
And it really goes back to earnings, right? Yeah. And the power of the earnings, that's going to support the market. And our theme coming into this year for investors was to be fearless, right?
It.
So yes, we may have geopolitical events, we may have pullbacks, but don't let that stop you from staying invested in your portfolio.
Absolutely.
Well, Gargi, this has just been such an insightful conversation. I can't thank you enough for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
And thank you for tuning in as well.
Thank you for watching or listening to the Friends of Sanctuary podcast. Tune in next month to be sure not to miss out on the next installment of the series.